Welcome to the Barely Superman podcast, a conversational podcast where I talk to you about things that matter to me today. And today is a good day. I woke up. Period. No, I didn't wake up with a period. I woke up today. I didn't think I was going to. I was so tired yesterday. And yeah, no. That's good. So trying to continue on this steam train, trying to make sure that I record a lot more, and here I am. So last week we talked about Star Wars. This week the topic is ambition. Now ambition is actually really interesting, because ambition in and for the most part is seen as something negative. So what is ambition? Ambition can be described as a strong desire to achieve or do something. It's also a desire and a determination to achieve success. Now, that on paper, in theory, sounds good. However, there are some cultural perceptions on what defines ambition. And ambition is not as easy to define as you might think, because for the most part, ambition is seen as a bad thing. From my experience, ambition is seen as trying to be and trying to do something that society believes that you're not capable of doing. So you are essentially locked down to society's perception of you. And by trying to achieve more, you seem disingenuous. And you also seem like you're undermining other people's work. It's a really weird concept. So I was reading this article on BBC, bbc.com. It was titled "Ambition: Do You Really Need It to Succeed, or Do You Need It to Succeed?" Was the title, and they go through the various research and like a 30-year corporate ladder. Some guy who's like 58 and he landed a job, and now he's worked in Burlington, Massachusetts, based on data protection, and it's interesting, and it's what he said that kind of struck me as something that I needed to talk about, like with ambition. He said, "There's no secret formula or silver bullet. It's something in my DNA," which made me think about ambition. Is it innate, or is it something that we learn from the people around us? Is it nature or is it nurture? And this really struck a philosophical interest in what I define ambition. And to do that, I wanted to kind of look at my history with how I've seen myself, I've driven myself, how my ambition has changed over time, and how, if at all, the environment affected my ambition, my drive. So ambition, by this article, or two university professors, define ambition as mostly about striving for status and achievements. And that's the key word here, status. So there's been a lot of pushback with this idea of ambition being about status, and there's different cultures perceive ambition differently. For example, in Japan, if someone is too outwardly ambitious, people around them, the co-workers, would always not want to work with them, because it's kind of like undermining their, like, they're supposed to be a unit. And if someone's trying to leave that unit, it's kind of like, we don't gel. In China, the government used to provide people jobs for life. And because of that, because of the rapid growing economy, if people are far freer to jump from job to job than move up in the chain, because these are jobs for life. So what is really the factor that kind of determines ambition? Is it something that we grow up knowing that we're going to be successful, or is it something that's instilled in us? And one of the major factors in how we we are driven, we find drive, we find ambition, is self-esteem. And self-esteem is a massive contributor to ambition, because it's all about the psychological state you're at. Someone who thinks highly of themselves or herself won't necessarily rise through the ranks. But the more self-esteem you have, the more ambitious you are, because you think you can do things, more likely you rise up. As the great man Bane once said, "Rise, brother." So whether you have specific talents or whether you don't have specific talents, ambition, so long as you have that kind of drive that you believe that you can do better, you will always do better. And from my history of how I've risen up the ranks, so to speak, I want you to kind of extrapolate whether my condition was nature or nurture, because obviously I'm subjective in my matter, and I can't be 100% objective because, again, it is my life. So before I get into that history of myself, like, I just wanted to like look at like one more thing in terms of the best kind of ambition. So being an easygoing team player, I know it's like the corporate like BS, but barely Superman. But you know, that's the thing. Before, let's not even get any further, right? Anytime, this is the new challenge. This is the new challenge. Anytime someone says BS, you have to say barely Superman. Like, taking inspiration from Beyond, from Podcast Beyond. Actually, that's a cool idea. I'm gonna do that from now on. So anytime someone says BS, I'm gonna whisper, and I'm gonna seductively whisper in their ear, barely Superman. Yeah, that's the new thing. So, wait, where was I saying? Oh yeah, so the best kind of ambition. If you're always focused on the job, if you work hard and you focus on the work you're doing, work gets easier and people see you as someone who's no longer in the boundaries that were tied in with the societal's expectations of you. And that's the best kind of ambition. But is it? We'll come back to that. So in order to kind of go into the nature versus nurture approach of ambition, I'm going to do something that I've never done before, and I'm going to talk, well, I have done it once, but it was partially. Again, this will tie into goals and drives and ambition, and that's my drive for actually wanting to be successful. And you'll find that in my life, women take a major part in ensuring that I stay hungry, as the great late Steve Jobs once said. Give me a second, I just need to write down a time code. It is 8:42. Alright. Cool. You'll hear typing from now and again. That's just me updating a time code just in case something happens, or my mic falls down, or my PC crashes. That's probably just me just writing down what time everything crashed. It's never happened. Well, maybe it has happened once or twice before. That's purely because I would do something stupid and it would crash. Yeah, I'm also drinking tea, so for any ASMR people out there, eat your heart out. So anyway, ambition. I've never really talked about my history and my work history in particular, that's kind of weird. I've never talked about my work history, and I thought it would be something fun to document so that I can have it in my time capsule. Wow, I've already gone for 10 minutes and I've spoken about absolutely nothing. Fantastic. So, my work history. I started working when I was about 10. That's the earliest when I started working. And this is mainly because my dad has really strong work ethic, and he believes that if you really want something, rather than begging and pleading for people to give it to you, just go out and get it yourself. That is the epitome, the foundation of the American dream. And as we all know, I'm an Americaphile? Is that Americaphile or Americanphile? Americanphile would suggest I'm in love with all Americans. So Americaphile. Alright, cool. So yeah, when I was 10, the only jobs you can do at 10 are like paper route or route. Why did I say route? That's such an American thing to do. Paper route. I've never said route before. What is happening? I'm sick. I'm more sick than I thought. Oh my good lord. I wanted to do the paper route. It was interesting because it was at the time where there was a lot of kidnappings in the news. So like my parents were really against me doing paper route, and because of that, I never really got to go to my first day of job. Because they were like, nah, you'll probably get kidnapped. Actually, my mom was like, you'll probably get kidnapped. My dad was like, who'd want to kidnap this child? Good luck kind of thing. And it was, so I never did the paper route kind of thing, which was, something I really actually wanted to do because I really wanted that pocket change. And because of that, I had to get really creative in how I made money, because video games were expensive. They were about £60 back then. It's a long time ago anyway. I'm not doing the math, my head really hurts. And it was really weird trying to figure out ways of making money, and not money quickly, because making money quick is always going to be easy. It's making a sustainable amount of money that's the hard part. So what I tried to do was, I tried to negotiate having lunch money, because obviously I needed lunch money. So I would get like an allowance of like something like £5 a week or something. This was for lunch, which allowed me to have £1 meals alongside any sandwiches that I made, which was it was okay. It wasn't enough to sustain the kind of meals that everyone else was getting, that like whenever people were getting like the fish and chips and stuff, that would mean I'd spend £1.20 or £1.30 of my £5, and that's not sustainable. And back then I was a real health nut, and I didn't do the fish and chip life, so I didn't want to spend that 50p going to the fish and chips, because I was working towards getting my six pack, because I was the captain of the badminton team, and I also did karate all the time. And then back then, I really wanted to kind of boost my image, as you would want to when you're younger, because I don't know. For me, I just had an odd fascination with the, well, I still do, the male physique, and like the amount of effort and time you have to put in to get like a form that you really want. It's not something that happens overnight, and it's something that I kind of picked up from doing karate. That the harder you work at something, the more you chisel at a rock, the prettier and the smoother it gets. And that's what I wanted to do. And because I wanted to also try out for long distance running, as a Kenyan, you had to do long distance because that's what my body was built for at the time. I was training to do that, and having a well balanced diet and like just being good to your body was important to me back then. So that was like part of the ambition back then. So And because English was not like I could barely speak English, so I needed to have something to showcase for. All right, I will be right back. Let me set the time code. That's 15. And I'm back. Sorry about that. There was a knock on the door, so I had to get that Amazon parcel. I don't know what's inside. Been ordering quite a few bits. Anyway, back to the story. So I really wanted to... I tried out for everything. All the sports. Basketball, football, volleyball, which I was the captain of. But not this year. I became the captain 3 years later. Badminton, as I've mentioned. I did all the athletic based things. So I did the 100 meters, 400 meters. I did the long distance one. Can't remember how many it was. I didn't do shot put because like my body was not built to like throw that heavy piece of. Ugh, I hate a shot put. But I was really good at javelin. In fact, I was one of the strongest candidates for my school for javelin. Even though it was kind of weird because like no one expected me to have so much upper body strength. I didn't expect myself to have that much upper body strength. But yeah, I was really good at that. So that was my drive, and I really needed to make money, but without impacting one, my health, and two, the sanity of my parents, because like I didn't want them to worry about me potentially getting kidnapped or like dying, and they wouldn't know how to contact me because I didn't have a mobile phone, so they had no way of contacting me. And so what I decided to do was I started to I didn't decide to do anything. It was the whole like Jamie Oliver movement where like everything started to become healthy, and they started to remove all the vending machines from schools and all the sweets and the candy and the chocolates and the everything that you would want to have to eat. They were all removed from schools, and this was the first time in my life where I was like, I can make a business here. Like I have a business case. I have customers, and I need to use my wits to kind of win things over. So I stopped using my lunch money for lunch, and I used to learn how to, that's when I started to learn how to like properly cook, because I needed to make sure that I use ingredients that are at home to make my school lunch, so that when I go to school I have a lunch, but I then have that lunch money so that I can be like, yeah, what's up, I got that £5, and with that £5 I used to buy, what is it, 500 Freddos or something. And because you're not allowed to leave school when you're in primary school, you're not allowed to leave the premises. I used to have 500 Freddos. Was it 500 or 50? 50. What did I say 500? It's because I'm thinking £5 is 500p. Yeah, divide that by 10. Good luck. Like I said, my head hurts. I used to get 50 Freddos. Sorry. That's what I meant to say, 50 Freddos, because it was like 500, like, I'd fit my bag in, like, yeah, no, it's 50 Freddos. The first few months, it was like, I used to get 50 Freddos, because that's 10p, however, you hike the price to 15p, because people really want that, and you're like, look, you either get it from me now, or wait till the end of the school day to have a piece of chocolate. Up to you. And then I'd sell about half of those, so I'll sell 25, and then I'd keep the 25. And then for a few months I did that with that extra 5p, and I used to put it in this like little jar thing. I think people call it a piggy bank. I've never liked the idea of putting my money inside another animal. But yeah, I used to put it in a jar, and then I accumulate those 5p's, and then after like 2 or 3 months, I started buying like more expensive chocolate. So I used to go to, there used to be a place called Netto. People didn't like to go there because it was a status symbol kind of thing. If you're like, you go to Netto, you're like cheap and you're like dingy. But like, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm going to get that for cheap. So I used to buy like the really expensive chocolate for really cheap and then sell it at the price that they were selling it at the corner store. And then I started making 10p, 15p per chocolate. And I started putting that aside, and I kept putting it aside, and I was like, all right, this is the money I need to make. And then eventually it took me something like 6 months or something, so to have enough money to buy like two games. But at that time, like, I found that everyone had already kind of played those games, and like I had really, really rich friends at one point, and they were like, hey, you just want to have this game. I don't really need it anymore because I've already played it. And I'm like, hell yeah, give me that game. Like, that's what I want. Yeah, boy. And I started like saving my money, and I kept saving my money, and then it just started to accumulate, and I started to continue with this business. And this business kind of went on for a few years because yes, I started it in essentially end of year six, and then year seven, and then year eight. I started like selling more expensive chocolate, like Kinder Bueno, when Kinder Bueno was really hot. And then I started like diversifying my portfolio by adding like sweets. And I really, really like, I really had enough money to kind of do all of this. And then that's when things started to change. I needed to find a new way to make money because that money was no longer sufficient to kind of satisfy the needs that I had. So I moved on from selling chocolates and doing that to starting to help my dad at the office. It was unpaid, of course. Obviously, family doesn't pay, but I started picking up a few things about electronic engineering and yeah, it was mainly electronic engineering, like how to set up a router from scratch, like how to build computers, that kind of thing. And then at the time, like, I may have not been like, sometimes I had to go to work with my dad because like no one was at home to look after me. And like those days where I'm like, oh man, when, like, oh, I don't want to do this. But then, like, it was something that someone said a few weeks later. There was like one specific day where I went to work with my dad, and I was like, man. And then my friend was like, man, I would really love someone to like fix my controller. And I was like, I can have a look at it. Like, I can look at this. And then I saw it, and it was just like a simple screw that had come loose, and I was like, I can make money from this. And that's what I did. I started fixing people's electronics. And I was significantly cheaper than taking it to like Computer Exchange or taking it to GameStation or even trying to even replace it through the conventional means, like, or taking it to like the shops that usually like repair your phones and stuff. So I was significantly cheaper than those guys, and people started bringing this stuff to me. And then people started asking me for really odd requests, like, can you install this operating system, or can you help me pick out the phone I'm gonna do? And I used to charge for that. And I used to make a significant amount of money. And with that money, over the years, I started saving it up, and it started to accumulate with all the 5p's and 10p's that I accumulated from buying and selling chocolate. Like, all of that started to accumulate. And then one day, I had a really, really interesting business idea. I was thinking to myself, and this was actually after I went to Computer Exchange. I went to Computer Exchange, and then I essentially sold all my favorite games to get one game. And this one game was not even for myself, it was for my cousin. I sold six or seven of my favorite games to get my cousin Budokai 3 for Christmas. And because I knew like he really wanted to play that game, like we really love the Budokai series, so I really wanted to get that for him. And then I started to think to myself, we have a cousin. We still have a cousin called Kevin, and Kevin is the type of person who absolutely trashes his controllers. And the games like Dragon Ball Z Budokai are like the reason why you can really damage your controller. And people that rage quit quite often throw their controllers at a wall to the floor, and they break their controllers. And when I was at Computer Exchange, when I was getting ripped off, I looked at one of the controllers, like one of the GameCube controllers, and I was like, it was only 99p because it had been refurbished, and it wasn't like the out of the box, like straight brand controller. So I sold the controllers and I was like, 99p, I have essentially £20. I'm gonna buy all the controllers in the shop. And I bought all the controllers in the shop. And then when I went to school, I kind of like, I was like, there was this guy who'd always broke his controllers. And I was like, yo, I know a guy. Of course, I'm the guy. I know a guy who can hook you up with a controller. Just let me know. Give me the side cash. Like, give me the half of the money right now. I send it to him to know that to let him know that you're interested. And then, I'll get you some controllers. Like, what colors do you want? And he's like, all right, man. I'll give you half the money now. I need. I'd love like a purple controller. I'm like, all right, cool. I can sort you out. So at this point, I've bought all the controllers in Computer Exchange, and I made sure, like when we went, I made sure that, like, to sell my business case, when I went out with this dude to Computer Exchange, we were like, hey man, let's look for a controller. And then I was like, I told him to kind of ask if they have any controllers. They're like, nah, we're all sold out. And then we went to Game, and the controllers were $9.99. And this is where I drove my kind of my business on him. I was like, look, I know a guy. He can sell it for you for six. It's $9.99 at this place. So, I mean, you're saving £3. Like, you're helping a brother out. And he was like, yeah, man, why not? Let's do it. So he gave me the £3. I took like a day or two intentionally to make it seem like it's a legit thing that I know a guy. And then I came back the next day and I was like, hey, here's a controller. And then I was like, you know what? Because you're a good dude, he said, let me give you this extra one for free, so long as you give him a shout out. Just tell your people that, like, he's doing business. Like, he rolls like that. And when he did that, like, that's when it started, like, that word of mouth. Like, everyone at the school, everyone, like, some people at Whitmore and Noah Hill knew about this guy who was selling controllers for cheap. And I had about 20 controllers at this time. And then within a month or two, I had all of them sold out for £6. And that's essentially a £5 profit per controller. And what I did with that profit was I bought all the controllers in all of the computer exchange, all of them. So I went to the computer exchange in Harrow, bought all the controllers. I went to the Uxbridge branch. I bought all the controllers. I needed to create supply and demand. I needed to make sure that people couldn't buy the controller for cheaper elsewhere, but they couldn't buy the official controller for too expensive. So I created a middle ground, and because of that, like, I had in the lifetime of it, I had like 40 controllers, and I sold all of them. And then what I used that for, I used that to buy consoles, because, like, now this was when, like, the console was changing. It was going from the GameCube. Like, people for some strange reason wanted to have a GameCube and a Game Boy Advance, because, like, after years of bashing Zelda and Mario Kart and everything, like, people were like, oh, these are childish games. People were like, no, nah, actually, you know what? They might be fun. So everyone, like, there was a trend that it was going around where, like, people wanted to have a GameCube. And I just decided to go to Computer Exchange to just, I bought so many GameCubes. I bought like 15 GameCubes. And then because Computer Exchange didn't have any GameCubes anymore, and because I'd bought most of them, what I did was, like, I kind of like to kind of add to that selling point of like, hey, I can give you like this GameCube. I created a kind of deliver to your house kind of thing, where it's like they don't have to leave their house. I just bring the GameCube to their house and they pay me up front, that kind of thing. No tax. That's the most important. No tax. It's cash in hand, no tax. So I made money that way, and then I used that to kind of fund my music, because at that point I started, after years of doing music, being a level eight on drums, really, really becoming more proficient at DJing, because I started DJing when I was six. I started, like, putting my music out on MySpace, and I needed new equipment, so I started buying equipment for that. So I started with mics, simply just like to get like the Trapaholic mixtape, like that kind of thing, driving in the background, so that, like, I could I could MC on the tracks that I do, like adding a personal touch. And I posted it on MySpace, and on MySpace, I don't know how or why I went viral, and then overnight I started getting two friend requests, and then three, and then 10, and then 15, and then at one point I had 50,000 friends on MySpace, and of the 50,000, I had about 10% engagement with my content, which kind of allowed me to kind of get enough money to have a subscription for Live 365, which was online radio. And back then, internet wasn't like the best, so I used to have to go to the library to kind of upload the music. And then it got to a point where my internet was semi-stable enough to kind of host a radio stream. And this is when I jumped to Tiscali. So I used to have a radio show where I used to do a live set every Thursday. It was right after A State of Trance aired in Germany, or right before, one of the two. It was like right after, right before, because people would be really hype. No, it was definitely before, because I would get people hype on music that's probably going to be showcased in the Armin van Buuren set. And I used to not make money from directly hosting, but my money came from the sponsorships that people attached to, like local companies would come to me and be like, "Hey, can you just plug our thing for this on your radio station?" Now, to them, it was win-win. Like for them and me, it was win-win, because like they don't spend as much money like hosting it to a really expensive radio station, and I get like really minimal royalties, but like those royalties were enough to sustain the passion. And it came from a long way from like a dude who is just selling chocolate Freddos for school. So I started like doing this Live 365 thing, and then one day I got an email from Live FM. Is it Live FM? Last FM? Yeah, I got an email from Last FM. They're like, "Hey, we really like your content. We're gonna create a channel for you." And I was like, "Hell yeah, man! Like, this is where it starts, man. This is where I start to get popular. This is where I can make something off of this." And then when I got the and then I had my own channel. And then the thing about having your own channel on Last FM, it means that when someone's playing their music on 'cause like Last FM was a radio, like an online radio station. When like they'll finish their track, it would try to match their track to the next track. And because they needed filler content, like sometimes I'd be the filler content. So like someone would be listening to their Kanye, and then like my set would come on to be like to add as filler, and like that kind of boosted my MySpace kind of popularity a little bit more back then. And I started earning enough to go to the recording studio and actually make the tracks that I wanted to make. And for me, I didn't make tracks for me, because I was never in it for like the artistic expression, which is like I've always found like, oh, you need to express yourself. Like I wasn't in for that. I used to like I found that you'd make more money sustainably commissioning your music, because UK is very it's a I've always said this, and I'll say this time and time again. UK is very local in the way that they produce their music. They never think about like the global success. So what I did was I used to commission my music to like up and coming artists in on that record label. I never signed to that label, but because I didn't want to be tied to a contract. But I used to do commissions to for tracks. So like I go into a studio, and then a guy would be like, "Hey man, I need a track that's I need to bust a beat on." And then we like work for like 2 or 3 days on a track, like 2 or 3 intensive days on a track, and then I'd sell off the track to them, so that if they become successful, like I was never part of that. That track is theirs. They made that. That's a creative vision. So like it's works for them in terms of marketing, and it works for me because I remain a ghost. So I started doing that, and I was really good at it. And it got to a year where like my auntie passed away, and And I lost all creativity that year, mainly because when you're dealing with grief and you're trying to be creative, sometimes you go into a dark place, and the music that you're producing, especially if like you're creating grime, like it was too dark, like for like people that wanted to kind of listen to it, like because people love me for like the music that kind of got them hype, like the EDM kind of world. So when I went into like that grime world, that dubstep world, like the original dubstep, not the like the Skrillex dubstep, the Magnetic Man dubstep, like that's where I like kind of I found my drive, and I kind of that's when I put my artistic expression. But after a while, I started to see the music industry for what it was, and I was like, I don't know whether I want to continue just being this silent ghost. So my uncle, he owns the biggest label in East Africa. He was like, yo, you wanna come work for me? And I'm like, and I was at the time, this is the time I'm 18. I was thinking, hey, maybe I do wanna. Maybe I do want to work for you. And my dad was like, you know what, like get your education first, because like you never know with this kind of thing, you can always mess up. And I was really debating like whether I want to just go straight into the music industry. And it's at this point where I need to kind of create a fork and then go back in time to when I was 16, because the ambition was not just artistic. I also had to make money on the for other endeavors, and this is where I start to talk about how my ambition is not only driven by like my kind of my drive to want to succeed. It's also driven by the people around me, and specifically a girl. So in my life back then, there was a girl called Eliza. Now Eliza is like the most high maintenance of all my friends. Oh, here we go. I'll be right back. I think I was talking about Eliza, so I'm gonna jump back into that. Yeah, Eliza was this girl that was she was in my year, and she came in year 9, and at the time she was really into this dude called Alex, my boy, my brother. And Alex was really into her as well, and like at the time, like because they were really into each other, being the awkward third wheel I am, like we were all good friends at the time. And the thing is with like people that are really high maintenance is like, and back then, because she was like fresh, oh, my mom hates that phrase, oh my God, she was like from another country. She imported, as you would like to say, first generation emigrant. Emigrant is not, I didn't say immigrant, I said emigrant, someone who moves from country to country. Yeah, so she emigrated from Poland, and like she was really new in the country. And with her, like she was the type of person that was like she really wanted to get her way. And at the time, I was really, really strong as a Christian, and I thought, like do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. So like there were times where like I really wanted to do something, and she was like, I don't have any money. So I'll be like, you don't worry, I got you. And I used to pay for her things, and then that kind of facilitated that kind of greed, because like she wasn't the type of person that would hold back. So in order to sustain that friendship and having to want to kind of do the things that I wanted to do, the things that I loved, I needed to kind of fork over an extra person's pay. And I did that for a few years, and I have no regrets in doing that, because she is primarily the reason where like I needed to get like more money, because she became this figurehead in my life that was ensuring that I was never not hungry. She always ensured that like I always had extra cash. I always had an abundance of cash, because I knew that she would siphon it off one way or another, and that's the role she played in my life. Nothing more, nothing less. I mean, we did become close friends at one point, but that died off quickly when she became, yeah. Anyway, no slander in the podcast. Thank you very much. No, so yeah, and the reason why I jumped back to when I was 16 is when I started to do proper work. I worked in the library for a while, and people were always like, why would you pick the library of all places? One, books. You get smarter by books. Major key, as DJ Khaled would once say. And then you have the, you have a lot of pretty intelligent people. And I'm not saying pretty intelligent. I mean, pretty and intelligent people would go to the library. And then because you're this person who's like always talking to them, like you've kind of removed the kind of needing to go to a date. And it was just like, I met so many people that I went out with from a library, and they were really, really like intelligent and sexy. And that's a combination that's hard to find. And so that's another thing that I went for the library for. But the most important thing that I went for the library was the benefits, aka free DVDs and CDs for music. So I had like free DVDs and music that I could rent out for, you know, I had my library pass, so I could just rent out as many as I wanted. And also the pay. Now, when everyone was getting minimum wage working in Primark, I was getting £10 an hour. Now, I want you to think back. This was years ago. £10 an hour. 8 hours, one day. That's all I needed to work. And on a Saturday or Sunday, it jumps to £11.50. It was great. I had cash, dude. I had cash, but I never spent that cash. Part of it went into the music career and stuff. Part of it went into videography and photography, which I will come to. And then part of it went into into my uni fund. So I was putting money aside for my uni, because I knew that uni was going to be really expensive because I was an international student, and I needed to make sure that I had uni fund sorted. So I started keeping the money aside. And then from that money aside, I also started putting money aside for my sister, because my sister would eventually have to go to uni. So I put money aside for that. And then I put money aside on the side of that, of emergencies, just in case, like, for example, something happens, like we get robbed or something. I needed to have enough money to get all the things that I lost back. And I did lose stuff. My phone was, I was always getting robbed. Because like when you're coming down from Harrow Weald, if you're not robbed, you consider yourself lucky back then anyway. And then I also had this thing where like my dad's contract had ended, and I was essentially told that that I had like 90 days like in the country before we had to like kind of export ourselves back to Kenya. And at this point where I told one girl, and she kind of told the school, because like I was like, I'm not sure if my dad's contract will get renewed. And like everyone like wrote like a goodbye card, and I was like, fuck, man, because like if my dad's contract gets renewed and I'm back next year, like that's going to be like a really awkward conversation. And that's exactly what happened, where like I came back and everyone was like, why are you here? Like, I thought you left. And I was like, my dad's contract kind of thing, but like no one understood, like everyone just thought like I kind of did that for like the sympathy thing, but like, it was kind of sweet of her to do that, but at the same time, like, it put me in a really awkward situation. And then at this point, it was where like Eliza had like was having problems with her dad, and like she had like issues with her, like grandma or whatever, right? So I told her, here's my Game Boy Advance, my most treasured device, right? I want you to hold on to it, because I know I'm going to be back one day, right? Go over the summer, like, whenever you're, like, you're feeling down or whatever, just, like, here's my Game Advance, here's all my games. Look after it, because I know, like, in times, like, of grief or whatever, you just kind of need, like, someone to be around, and because I'm not going to be around, I might not be around, here's my Game Boy, like, to kind of just like to sink into something, to do something, because otherwise you'll end up turning into like one of those street whores or whatever, which she did. Sorry, slander. No slander here. Anyway, I gave him my Game Boy Advance, and then my dad's contract got renewed like on the last week of like the 90 days. So after packing, we had to unpack, and then like whatever, and then that meant I was coming back to school, and then I was like over the summer, because she was in Poland, I had no way to contact her. And when she came back, I was like, hey, I didn't get to go. And she was like, oh, that's great. And then I was like, yo, do you have my Game Boy? And she was like, nah, man, I left it at my grandma's. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, whenever you next go to Poland, get it for me. And she was like, yeah, cool, I'll do that. And this was the first time where like I realized that this human being was not a good one. I was trying to not, honestly, the things I write, like to say, are just horrible. But like, yeah, no. So what I found out years later from a close friend, her girlfriend, was that she had sold it. Not a few years later, it was a year later. 'Cause like I used to always ask her like, "Where's my Game Boy?" or whatever. Like, I had enough money to buy another Game Boy, and every game that I gave her. But it was about the principle, 'cause like I had my Mario Kart, and that was my Mario Kart. This was a Game Boy that I had gotten for my birthday. This was my birthday gift. This was my Game Boy, so like I didn't want that anyway. So, what she did was she had sold it so that she can get some drugs, and it is what it is, man. Like, but the thing is, it was from that point on, like I started to not, I didn't trust her at all. And we still had like a close, I don't know why we hold on before that. It sounded like Christopher walking from. I'm like, it's fine. Listen, it's good. It's fantastic. So yeah, I started not to trust her, and this was like this moment in my life was the first time where I was like, I need to make money. I need to make money, and I wanted to make money. So as well as the music stuff, as well as selling stuff, as well as doing all of that stuff, and working at the library one day a week, I was like, I need more. I need more money, because the truth of the matter is, there are going to be women and men in the future that will be like this, and they will siphon your money, and you just need to have a contingency plan. You need to just make sure that you have money on the side, so that even if they take half your money, you can still make that money back. And that's how I've lived from then on. Like, I lose money, I make money. That's how it works. So going back to it, working for the library for a year or two, I left that, and then my friend's dad was working with the government, and we're talking about how they wanted to bring more engineers into schools, into universities. Because the UK had a sufficient lack of engineers, and we were importing from everywhere else, India and Poland and Hungary, and like we were having more external engineers than we were making our own. So what the government gave him like money to start a company. It was called Amnic, and it was a consultancy firm where the aim was to talk to universities and try to like find ways into introducing more engineers that were born and bred, not born, it's an expression, in the UK. So we have more UK-based engineers. And with that, he hired me for that job because, one, I had spent years of electronic engineering and audio engineering, so I was really grounded in the science of it all. And I was also, according to my interview, because I had a telephone interview with the guys, they didn't know how old I was. So when I was talking to them on a telephone interview, I was telling them ideas. They were like, "All right, cool, dude. I don't even need to have like a face-to-face interview. You are hired." And when I came in on the first day, they're like, Oh, you're like 16, you're 17 now. Like, interesting. So it was really cool because, like, I was in a really senior position as a really senior consultant, and I had power, and I used to have to interview people that were the same age as my dad, and I used to sit on a panel and interview these people, and that is the most, it's the craziest thing because interviewing someone who's older than you is like, it's always so daunting because like they look at you and they're like, why are you here? Like, what makes you special? And I really worked hard on that job, and I really, and it really paid off because I used to talk to all the universities, so Cambridge, Oxford, King's, UCL, Imperial, Greenwich, Queen Mary's. I spoke to all of them, and I created contacts for university. And when I applied to university and I didn't get in, because I was applying through the medicine route, I had to go through clearing. And with my luck, Machala luck, I lo my UCAS account was deleted in the on the ser from the servers, and no universities has had direct access to me, so I had to call my contacts and I'd be like, "Hey, look, I didn't get the UCAS requirements for medicine, but this is what I want to do. Like, I've chosen a course, which I chose from a hat, by the way. And here's the thing that I want to do." And my original plan was to do 1 year of that and then transition into medicine, like scale over change. And I knew that I didn't have enough money to kind of sustain 8 years of uni. I didn't even have enough money to sustain 2 years of uni, but I was like, I need to go into that medicine route because I wanted to help people. And I got into Kingston, and then because they were trying to do background checks and trying to like associate my UCAS, they were like, "Hey, we need to spend 3 days on this." And then for some strange reason, my place at Kingston was removed, and they were like, "We couldn't validate you on UCAS, so we had to remove your place and give it to someone else." And I was mortified. I was like, "This is the place I wanted to go, one of the places I wanted to go. This was one of my prime choices to go to uni." And like one of the unis, I called like Middlesex, I called everything else, and then I landed on Greenwich. And I called Greenwich and I was like, "Look, I haven't got the UCAS points that I need to, do this course, but like, here's my credentials. Like, this is what I do for a living. This is what I did." And they looked at me and they're like, "You know what?" And the guy who I talked to on the phone was like, "Look, just make sure you just get a 2-1, right? You come in, no messing around, right? Just get a 2-1, right? And then it will make me feel vindicated for allowing you to come to the uni." Because I essentially had like a telephone interview like with multiple people, and they're like, "Look, you don't have the UCAS points needed, but there's a place, and I don't think it's going to be filled up. It's not a course that people want to do." So I did computer science, and I got in. I did the Greenwich thing, and then that was ambition, and it's ambition that didn't come from wanting to kind of succeed. I did want to succeed, but it wasn't something that it was innate. It was something that was from circumstance. I gained this from circumstance, and with that, when I got into Greenwich, I was like, "Look, Greenwich is really expensive, and I'm bleeding out so much money." And with the Eliza Fund, I couldn't sustain that life. So what I did was I needed to make more money, and this is when I was 18, when I was like doing that, I stopped doing the music because I couldn't do both music and uni. I did it like once or for once 1 or 2 semesters, but that was it. So I was like, I need to make money, but like not be forced to do it on a schedule, which was what the radio station was. And with this, I kind of went back to, and my friend was talking about YouTube and like how this is, I think it was when like Justin Bieber was starting to like rise to popularity, and I'd been on YouTube for a while, but I wasn't really that big. I wasn't like a big player on YouTube, And I was like, I know how to game the system. Like every system has a game to play, and you just have to know how to play the game. And with YouTube, I started to see like I started to do research. I did hands-on research on like the channels that do successful, like the most successful channels. And I found that there's a lack of women in on YouTube. So I used to have this friend that used to really want to be an actor. So I told her, look, I'm gonna buy this camera, right? All I need to do is I need to position the camera above you so that it creates a perception of dominance for the male viewers, and also also suggests sexuality, because like it kind of like it promotes like when you wear like a crop top, like you kind of promote like the cleavage, and that's how like the female vloggers used to vlog at that time. And also when you have the camera directly above you, it's not intimidating when you're looking at it from a computer screen. So I started with this channel, and because I didn't want to be on the face of the camera, because let's face it, no one wants to look at this, and I was gesturing around my face. No one wants to look at this. So that's the first channel I kind of introduced, and I said, I'll run the channel. I'll make sure that you get your due pay and everything. All you have to do is just be yourself on camera. And like there will be days where like I'll find challenges for you to do, and then do that. And then she started her kind of series, and then provided material. I kind of like wrote jokes and stuff, and then her channel got like relatively successful for YouTuber. And then I was like, this is when I was like, I needed to build my case for a YouTube, like the YouTube partnership program. So back then, to be a partner wasn't like being a partner today. Being a partner today is essentially you sign up to YouTube, you get a Google account, you essentially hit submit, they do background checks, and then if in 5 minutes you're essentially set as a partner. Back then, being a partner was a much more stringent process. For me, it took me 8 months before I was approved to be a partner, and being a partner meant that you could monetize on videos, and not only monetize on videos, you could also have affiliate links directly pointing towards a certain site. For example, right now when you click on an annotation, you can actually add an annotation to take you to a different website. Back then with YouTube, you could not do that. You could not do that unless you had affiliate links. You could have unofficial affiliates through Google AdWords and such, but without the partnership program, you kind of lost out on a lot more, and you couldn't have even a banner, like a custom banner, because like all partners had like YouTube pages were so different back then, and the basic YouTube page was like plain and boring. But like back then, if you were a partner, you had like this customized banner where you could put your social media. So that's the first thing we did. This channel was now a partner, and then she was getting she got we split the thing 50-50, and then obviously YouTube takes like it's 50-50 out of a 60-40 cut, and then YouTube used to get like 40%. I don't think I'm allowed to disclose this information, but oh well. Anyway, so that's the first channel I did, and then I was like, all right, we're generating a lot more revenue with this. I need to build more channels. So the next channel I built was a gaming channel. Now, I had this friend who had like the most adorable German accent, and he was like he used to play really obscure games, and he's like a hardcore PC guy, and he used to love like building like really 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 high tech PCs, which meant that all I needed to do on my end was pay for Fraps. The pro version of Fraps, because like the free version of Fraps was always breaking when we were recording stuff. And when I got that, we started that gaming channel. That gaming channel, obviously, because he was playing like the popular games, the like and also back then he was also playing the games that people wanted to see. And not only that, he was playing them at 1080 or 720, and people went ape shit for that. They absolutely loved that, because unlike today, like HD streams are everywhere, but back then HD streams were niche. and people wanted to like compare the graphics. They wanted to look at the pretty graphics. So I launched that channel, and essentially, for the first few months, I let him. I curated the content, and then after a while, I kind of let him. I let him loose on that, and then eventually, I partnered with Flow Nerds, and then I joined as I think I joined as a COO or Chief Technology Officer. I was like one of the two because like I essentially dealt with their website, ensuring that the website was always running. We got DDoSed once, so I had to kind of create preventative measures for that. And then the other thing was like helping them kind of define their brand. So affiliate marketing, I did the affiliate marketing for that. So with that, we kind of formed a partnership. And then one of the major partnerships we formed was with the major partnership we formed was one with Nike or Nike, and the other one was with Unique Hotels or Unique Events, something like that. So with Unique Events, with Nike was it was really simple. Nike was like, they give us a product, we sell it, and a story. But with Unique Events, they are like celebrity holidays, and like all holidays for people that are rich. And what we did was we hired a videographer called James. Oh my God. Like I've always known his name, and then today is just like today I'm forgetting everything just because I'm saying it outwards. Anyway, James something, and he was really good. And then what I used to do the first for the first video, we kind of like I kind of directed like I gave him the what's it called storyboard, and I was like, this is how I want you to shoot it. And then we partnered with the DJ that was there to make like this crazy track, and then when you made that crazy track, I was like, this is what we need to do, because like we shoot the video and then we edit the video onto the track. We did the editing, and then that's how it was. The video had 500 views in the first 2 minutes, and then 1,000 and 10, and then it was like 20,000, and then 50,000, 100,000. Like we had made it. Like we had made that video. That video was big. So we let that YouTube money like come in, and that's when I started seeing YouTube money, because like that's when it was exactly the same time when Epic Mealtime was like rising to success. And because of this, like YouTube was like, hey, you've been a partner since 2007, like here's money, I'm going to give you money for camera equipment. And then they gave me camera like money for camera equipment. I'm like, hell yeah. And then they gave me £200 worth of advertising for AdWords and stuff. So I was like, man, like this is life, man. This is like when I was like hitting the highs, and I got really good at promoting videos on YouTube, because I knew how to like I knew how to tag the videos. I knew like when to edit the videos. I knew when to like upload the videos, because you have to upload at a certain time. And I also knew like how to the thumbnail was important, and like just all these little things. Like I became so good at like selling videos on YouTube that the I had this thing where I told anyone, like, I don't care who you are or how many views you think you can get, I can get you more because I know the system now. And yeah, and it was really good, and that's when I started like posting more of my personal stuff. And I didn't monetize on this video, because this video was essentially like this podcast, it was just like a gateway so that one day I can look back on that video. And when I started putting my face forward, like there's a reason why there's not that many black people on YouTube, because YouTube at the time was predominantly white, and it was a floodgates of like racism, and like people were just like there's one troll who like used to every time I post a video, immediately the video is posted, dislike, not even seen it, dislike my comments, dislike. I jump in the comment, like anything I said, like the people, there were just people that wanted to just tear me down. And with having like the stress of uni and all that, like stress of family, stress of everything in life, right, I was getting tired of like just being torn down every day. I was tired of just like pouring my heart out on a project, and then just having that project kind of destroyed by just like negativity. Because like, even though there was like the silent majority, it was just those one negative comments like that. They stick to your brain, and like, at first it didn't faze me, but like, after a while they started to stick, and then it's just like I started to post more, I started to do more, and my drive, my ambition was like, it was dampened. And this was around the period of time where like me and Eliza were essentially and effectively done. So I didn't have that like that woman in my life to ensure that I was making money. Obviously I had my girlfriend at the time, but like I didn't have that leech in my life that was there to as just to exist to siphon my money. So we exited from that situation, and then what I did was I gave the vlogging girl, like the girl who was, I don't want to name names, I don't want to like bait out their channels, because like some of these channels are not existing anymore. So I gave the girl the full rights to that channel. I had to have like this rigmarole with YouTube, and I said like, look, I started this channel, but like I want to pass it on to her, and then that means you need to create like an AdWords kind of section for her. So like she got her thing. James got his like own channel, and then after like, because like he didn't have any direction, he kind of like faded into the background. And then like the gaming channel as well, because like I when you have someone you work for, you have this kind of like connection, you have this drive, you have, you're thinking, hey, I'm not doing this for myself, I'm doing this for someone else. And because of that, he didn't have that. He started just playing games as he usually played, and he didn't record any of the videos, and he stopped posting the videos online. So all I had, and by the time I got to this point, like where I decided to like kind of shift my channel, I had about 8 to 10 channels. And then essentially because of that, I was considered an MCN, a multi-channel network. What I did was I just sold all of them. I didn't sell them for much, because obviously the value of a brand is nothing without the creative content. But I sold all of them. I gave full rights to the people, because I was like, we worked hard to build this thing, and I know you can like kind of, you're competent enough to be on your own. So I just sold it all, and I sold it all. In hindsight, I have no regrets. I know that if I ever wanted to, I could have been something spectacular, but at this point I was just like, it's not worth me being depressed over. After like the death threats, that's when I was like, this was enough. Like I had to leave that, because I'd already like, another topic for another day, but like I got a death threat in school, and this was unrelated to thingy. So like that kind of like hit home, and then like obviously there's things that happen in your life, and you're like, you can't like death. For some people, death doesn't have meaning, but like for me, I'd seen the other side, so I was like, this, it's not worth it. So I can't. Yeah, so I sold that off, and I stopped making that YouTube money. This is when I started actually getting, because I had a lot more brain power. I put that brain power into learning how to program, and because I was really bad at it, man, oh my god, I could not program to save my life. But I said, you know what, I need to make sure that I'm good at programming. And this is around the time where like Justina came into like, my life, and then she wasn't the leech that Eliza was. She obviously with their relationship and stuff, but with Justina, like Justina was like my drive, because like at the time me and Justina had like the same ambitions. We wanted to be better than what we were at the time, and she provided like the kind of sustenance to want to do more, and like we kind of like drove each other to become better. I'd like to think we drove each other to become better. So I practiced hard to like get into programming, because one of my dreams since I was like a little kid was to get into YouTube, I mean, not YouTube, to get to work in Google, not for Google, or with Google. I wanted to work in Google because it was from, like, when my dad, like, helped me build a Google server and he explained what Google actually did. And I was like, this is the most awesome company ever. I want to be part of that. And I really worked hard to, like, and I was going to go through the engineering route, as in electronic engineer, because I preferred hardware to software, because I just couldn't grasp software. And then one day I just woke up and I could program. And after a year and a half of practicing, like, it just didn't sink in. And then one day I had a dream. And I woke up and I could program, and it was so good to have that feeling. And with me and Shalamus, the main reason that I continue to program to this day, me and Shalamus, we worked hard, man. We worked hard. We did damage. And I went from this kid who couldn't do any programming to one of the best programmers in the university. And this was evident when we won Skills Week, because to put it in perspective, and I always water down how good I really am at programming, but someone like David, who is a child prodigy at programming, if someone like that can respect you, someone like Manthan can respect you as a programmer, then you're a good programmer. End of story. Despite anything that any Russian might want to tell you, I'm a great programmer. So suck a dick. I said no vindictiveness in this fucking podcast. Anyway, I need to make this explicit. Oh no. All right. Oh well. Anyway, so yeah, made money that way. YouTube, all of that good. Sorry for that noise. Made money YouTube, and then left YouTube, and then the DJ kind of career went down. And then I was like, I need to make money. And I was like, hey, man, now that I can program, I can actually build a company, because now all my ideas of, like, building apps can come to fruition. And so when I was talking to David, I was like, you know what, like, we could, MBD, nothing but distinction, can build a company, and we can actually build some ideas and, like, really be like hit Silicon Valley, because, like, I think I know I can make it, because, like, I wasn't thinking about making $1 million. I was thinking about making 100 million, because what is $1 million? $1 million is something that I've seen so many people in my life make, and $1 million isn't anything. Making 100 million was something. So at the time, me and Shalamus were building up some ideas, and the thing that I learned that is the best to do is you tell everyone to come up with an idea. Because ideas aren't the money. Ideas will never be the money. It's how you implement the ideas are. So, like, Shalamus started. He started this notepad of ideas that could make 100 million. And every week we would sit down and we would discuss the plan of action, like what we need. And then after 3 years of university, it came to the conclusion that, regardless of the idea that I have, I need to have connections. And because I went in such a rut in the years of 2010 to 2013, it was like my life just became a downward spiral after that. I was like, I've lost all the connections I used to have, but I need to make more. So what we need to do is spend, 5-6 years in the industry, get as many connections as you can, then you can start a company. Because starting a company now, because there's an oversaturation of just crappy startups, you'll eventually be seen as a crappy startup and no one would ever want to invest. So if you have, like, that initial seed fund, you have initial backers, and you have, like, dedicated backers who will always be there, like, when things go wrong, like, that's when you'll be successful. So we went out in industry, we went into respective ways. I wanted to learn more about startups, and so to do that, I needed to work for a startup. And the startup that I applied to work for was GWizards. Now, at the time, GWizards was not a startup that was making a lot of money. It was an Accenture-owned startup, But like I had great ideas, and when we went to GWizards, I needed to see if I had the chops to kind of like be my own man and like run my own company. So what I did was I tried to sell as much work to GWizards as I possibly could. So the aim was finding clients and then having to build the software for the clients. And the first client that we actually found was the CMRG. The CMRG is Computing and Mathematical Greenwich Society or Research Group or something. And they had a problem where their system was a legacy system, so they needed to upgrade everything, including the logo. So I commissioned myself to build their logo. I created a new logo for them, and then they were like, "Oh, this logo is great! Like, it would be great if we could, like, now that we have an updated system, we can have a revamped website." And I revamped the website, and like it was really pretty, and it was like top notch, and a lot of people saw this website, and eventually people started to come to GWizards to be like, "Hey, we've got this software, we've got this app, we want you to build it." And like we started hiring more people, and then it gained traction. And then like people like Manthan and Jamie, they were like key drivers into making sure that this place succeeded. And the quality of work that they programmed w ensured that GWizards was always like a top-notch Greenwich born and bred kind of startup. And GWizards over time grew and grew, and now like the hiring process, like because GWizards now is now a legit thing, because of the work we did there. I don't know why I went so high-pitched there. That was like fucking. I was Christopher walking like this is fine. No, because of the work we did there, it was so great, because now it's owned. Google decided to buy it, and now Google owns that, and it's now a legit thing that you can actually work for. And I'd like to think I'm the groundwork for them. One of the groundworks on the foundation. One of the foundation. You need to have a great foundation to have a solid system. So that was my first intro into like the startup life, and I started to see the problems with startups, and I realized quite quickly that if I was to start my own startup now, I would not make money. In fact, I would lose money, and I didn't want to lose money. I didn't want to ever put people in a position where like I owed money. I've never wanted to owe people money. So I started doing other things, and then towards my working end of working with GWizards, I realized that I needed to kind of be more proactive in the way I found sources. And it sounds weird to say, because I was already proactive in terms of getting work, but my proactive wasn't in the work sense. I was talking about the social sense. So we did like Accenture football, and from that Accenture football, I talked to people in Accenture, and then I went to dinners with them. And then with dinners, I started like talking to the people like on a personal level rather than just talking through LinkedIn. And on a personal level, then they started linking me to other people, and then other people started linking me to IBM, and then I started forming IBM contacts, and from IBM, I started to like talk to people from other companies, like what was the other one? Oh yeah, so the other startup was Coffee Meets Bagel. Now, Coffee Meets Bagel was a startup in Silicon Valley, where they were the whole premise was it's a dating site essentially, but like it's like the like let's meet kind of QE dating site. So Coffee Meets Bagel had conversations with the CEO, and I talked to some of the developers, and they really seemed keen on me coming to Silicon Valley to Valley not Silicon Valley I go to Silicon Valley to start work there, because again, that's one of my dreams. That's closest for me to get into Google. Work into a startup, build a startup, make money from the startup. Google takes you. Because I applied every year, and every year I got rejected from Google. I got a job offer from YouTube. That's different. I wanted to get a job in Google. That's where I wanted to be. And with that, I started building myself up and trying to build a reputation where people are like, "That's that black kid, been working all pretty much all his life. Just need to, you know." So yeah, my IBM contacts, Google startup contacts, and then when I went to I went to this conference, and I spoke to a guy, and he was like, he was telling me about how when he was working for Mozilla, and like the up and coming event, they were finding it difficult to find a photographer for campus party, and then I bought my tickets for campus party, and I was like, "Hey, look, I've already bought my tickets, but like I do photography." And I gave him my business card because, you know, that's how I rolled back then. And he was like, "Oh man, I'll have a look into it, and then I'll see what we see." No, look, I just gave him my business card as like here's my name, because like everyone butchers my name. I have a YouTube video about this, but yeah, I gave him my business card, so like he had my contact details. And then like a week or two later, I got an email from Telefonica. They're like, "Hey, look, we saw your photography, and we would like you to work with us, right? So we have two roles ready for you if you're interested. We have a photographer role, and we have a social media role." Now, there were a few people that applied to this job. There was quite a few people that applied to this job. I never applied to it. Someone looked at my event photography and were like, "This is perfect. This is what we need." And then I was like, "You know what? I've never done a photography gig, like a real photography gig. I've done like a few side weddings here and there. I've done a few event photography for when I go to Comic Con and stuff." And then he was like, "You know what? Let's come to Telefonica. We'll discuss this even further." And when I went to my interview for Telefonica, the guy from Mozilla, well, not the CEO, the guy who was presenting, I can't remember his name, my good lord, like everyone's name I've forgotten today. I should really have written them down, but I didn't think I was going to forget them. I didn't even think I was going to do a shout out. Anyway, the guy from Mozilla came to like into that office, and was like to the guy who was getting me for Telefonica. He was like, "Oh, you guys are having a photographer. Why don't you photograph, like do some photography for us? We'll give you a criteria for every day, and then we just need 10 or 15 photos from you." And I was like, "Oh, cool." I was gonna hit that quota anyway. I usually take about 100 photos per day, and then edit it out to make around 60% get through of that 100, so 60 photos. And then of those photos, I produced 20 quality photos, 20 like outstanding photos, if I do say so my goddamn self. So I did all of that, and then working with them, I started getting contacts with so many people. Like a More Magazine CEO was like, we became like close friends. Well, close friends. We became friends. I got to talk to Steve Bushnell. I got to interview Boris Johnson. I interviewed people that were making so much more money than I could ever dream of, and I learned so much from them. And I realized that I was far too inexperienced to ever want to start my own company. So I started building like more relationships, and with that, and this is around the time period where like Lily came into my life. And like Lily, unlike all my previous girlfriends, she was like not the typical archetypical girlfriend. And I'll come into like relationships and like ambition and relationships in a short while, but I'm still gonna go through this history. And so with that, I kind of moved forward into just trying to establish something unique, something different. Trying to build as many connections, trying to learn as much, and talk to as many people. And eventually, that connection landed me with Microsoft. So that was actually fantastic because like Microsoft was showing off their Xbox One for the first time in the UK in Campus Party, and with that, it's like they took me behind the scenes like one day and they're like, "Hey, here's the Xbox. You can play around with it. Like, here's the games." I was so cool, man. That was so awesome. It was so dope. Like just being around like this like brand new tech that no one else in the country would have access to, and I was just there playing it. I was playing a game that no one else had played. I was playing Rise, and I was like, man, this is the fucking future. This is the fucking future. And I this is when like my ambition started to come back up. I was like, I'd lost it for a while. I just needed this kick. I needed like 'cause like I regardless of how we want to try to perceive everything, there's still racism in like employment. Like it's still there. Like we can try to sugarcoat it, but there's still a quota. There's still like, oh, we have to employ X amount of this race or this race. And also like because of that, because there's a limited number of a race or another, people tend to like to employ people that are not the most like the most not the people that are most skilled for the job, but the people that they gel with. And obviously this is often I've seen it before because like we have a we know a person who works in HR, and like one day she came in and she was like, "I don't know who I want to hire. This guy is really cute, or this guy is like really good for the job." And I'm like, "That's bullshit, man. That's fucking bullshit." Anyway, but that's how the world works, and we all know how the world works. And you know, you just have to be better than everyone else if you're put in this situation. You'll try to be better. Is that a good thing? That's the thing about ambition. Is ambition a good thing? Like, throughout this entire process, I'm just thinking, does ambition, is it good? 'Cause trying to be better than everyone else alienates yourself. It alienates yourself. And anyway, we'll come back. We'll come back to it. Like, this is the whole point. You're supposed to make your own conclusions on what's happening and what's going down. Down. Good Lord, this headache is getting so bad. I still have like it's well, 12:30. 12:30. I can still go on for a little bit. I want to make like 2 hour long podcast. Let me just have a sip. A sip. Oh my God, that tea is so cold right now. Oh yeah, so Telefonica was great. I learned a lot, met a lot of people, and then the events with Lily kind of like I transcended further down that spiral, and things were bad and my ambition was lost, and I didn't know what I wanted to do next with my life, because I knew I was definitely not ready to be part of a startup, and I was definitely not ready to be in like corporate environment. So my boy Waleed saw this thing on the newsletter for the King for King's newsletter. At this time I'm doing my master's, and it had like two job offers, and he had applied to one of them. Like one of them was like the King's clinical trial thing, but I had forgotten which one he had applied to of the two options, and I was like I didn't want to I because like I didn't know. He hadn't got the offer yet, so I didn't want to like step on anyone's toes. I didn't want to like create any tension between the two of us, because you know, like brothers shouldn't really fight for the same position, like or the same girl or anything really. So what I did was I applied to the one I thought he didn't apply to, which was the CTU one, and then on the phone, like when I was talking to the boss, he was like, "Oh yeah, there was a guy with like similar credentials that applied to it," and I was like, "Oh shit!" And then I told him like straight up, I was like, "Look, I don't want this position if Willie doesn't get it."
if there's room for two people, that would be great. But like, if there's not, like, I don't really need this job. I don't need to make this money because I have, I can find other ways of making money. Money isn't really the most important thing to me right now. The most important thing was sanity. I didn't say the last few parts, but like, I was just like, I don't need this job. If there's an extra position, that's great. But if there's not, then it is what it is, kind of thing. He was like, no, it's cool. We have a second position. You can fill it. And I'm like, all right, cool. That's it. I, like, come in for an interview, and that interview was horrible, man. Like, it was just like right after I'd had a fight with the GF, and I wasn't even paying attention. And it was like that dude had a way with words, man. He knew the right words to piss me off. And with that interview, I was really pissed off with that interview. But like, I got a call 3 days later where he said I got the job, and I was like, all right, cool. And then I came in, and then he realized I wasn't the invalid that he once thought I was. But yeah, that was a really good job, because it was then I learned how to use a Mac, because like I was so anti Mac until I used one, because of just the price point, and like, and also it was because of the my experience with Lion. That computer had Mountain Lion, and like, having that Mac experience, I thought about the possibilities and like what I could use the Mac for, and it was the perfect device for me to use for my project, my uni project, because a Mac is Linux based, and I could write scripts for my uni project, and I needed to write scripts, because otherwise, if I didn't buy a Mac, I would have most likely failed that project, because I wouldn't have had a way to kind of do my project in a way that I wanted to do my project. Because like, the Mac OS, people can argue, oh, why didn't you just get Ubuntu? Because like, Ubuntu sucks, man. Just like, get over yourself. I don't need, like, it's like Android. I fucking hate Android. Like, it's the most pointless. It's the most pointless OS, honestly, because it gives you like so much customizability, but I'll never need that. I'll never need that bullshit. I mean, Android just needs to fucking chill the fuck out. Let me. And also, it's perceived. I'm gonna go into a tangent for Android a little bit. Bear with me. It's a perceived sense of customizability. Like, on the Android OS, you're forced to have like three to five pages, where you might not necessarily have apps on it, and then when you want to launch an app, you can't search for the app unless you do the OK Google. Now, I mean, there's benefits and pros and cons for Android. But like, at the moment, Android is not an OS where I'm like, I want to spend all my time on. I will spend 50% of my time on. And iOS, I have problems with iOS as well. I will spend 50% of my time on it. And this kind of distribution is the reason why I have two phones. Both systems are not great. And one, I clearly prefer one over the other. Anyway. So that happened. And then I started applying to jobs left, right, and center right after the breakup. That was because, like, I had no ambition. I just needed to just apply, just to make sure that I wasn't damaging my future because of the state I was in. So I started applying to different jobs. I didn't get into IBM. I got to the final stage for IBM, but I didn't make it towards the end. I didn't make it to TFL. I didn't make it to, I mean, I made it to other things, but then I had like four candidates, and then I made it to the final stage, and I got an offer, and the most prevalent one was BBC, and BBC was offering a lot of money, and that's really the role I wanted to do, because it kind of aligned with my goals with wanting to build my own company, because I knew if I went to BBC, I knew that within 5 or 6 years, I would have my own company. And then Waleed was like, why don't you just join Deloitte? And I was like, I don't even know about this company. I don't know what they do. And then, like, I did research on it. And I was like, all right, cool. But, like, I was looking at the role that he was suggesting, like, going into digital. And I was like, man, I hate these fuckers, man. Like, everything about digital, I hate. I hate that. I hate that lifestyle. So I didn't want to apply to that. And then one day a recruiter called me, and they were like, "Hey, we saw your profile on LinkedIn, and you'd be perfect for cyber." Which is funny, because that's where Waleed was at. So I was like, I don't know what made you think that, but like, clearly doing my degree kind of swayed you in one way. And I was like, and also you have to remember, this is a time where like, I was not performing well for my master's. I essentially limited myself to ensuring that I only got 50 and not much more than that. Except for when the Russian told me that, he insinuated that he was smarter than me. And I essentially worked hard on the course that he was the strongest at to make sure that I got a higher grade than him, because that's how vindictive I can be. And I did, obviously, because, you know, I'm not an idiot. I come from a family with high IQs and shit. The Deloitte thing came in, and then I got another email from my girl Ankita saying that she received her CV, my CV, in Deloitte, and they were thinking of putting me in cyber, but more specifically IAM. That this is now two people from Deloitte that have called me, and she was like, "Oh, it won't be a grad scheme." And I was like, "All right, I'm cool with that. Like, coming in as a consultant, that'd be great." So I had my interview. The first interview was hell. My good lord, that was hell. I had a second interview, and then that was significantly better. My nerves were like way down. And then, like, straight up, he said, like, "I think we're going to hire you." Like, there's no confirmation or anything. But the problem is there's like this was like off the record, and he was like, "The problem is, like, we have some political issues with your case, because a few partners don't want you to come in as an experienced hire, as a consultant, and and one partner in particular wants you to come in straight away, because like we are heavy on work." And the problem with that was, like, this wasn't what I was kind of offered. So I was supposed to come in as a consultant, but they were like, with the 2.5 years of consulting work that you've done, like, we can't really, we can't hire you as a consultant." But I was like, "Hey, look, when I was 16, I worked as a consultant. Does that count?" They were like, "Yeah, we'll put that in consideration." And then a few weeks later, when I had my other interview, they were like, "Hey, look, because it's not a consultant in the technical field, that's how they were going to use it as ammo against me coming in as a consultant. However, they're like, "Hey, look, you're going to be coming in December. So if you come in December, you'll be just as good as the second year analysts. And it will mean that you will just be able to go for promotion this year." And I was like, "All right, that makes sense. Because like, that means that 2.5 years can become the 3 years that they needed." And then I was like, "All right, cool, I can live with them." So obviously this was not on paper. This was never on contract, because my contract, the contract that I signed, was so wishy-washy, and I was so hesitant on signing it, because like, I was like, why would I want to sign this hesitant, like, this like wishy-washy contract with Deloitte when I can easily be making a hell of a lot more money with BBC? But I was like, you know what, like, I worked with Waleed before, and it's always a good time. So rather than like just sacrifice your pride for once and just like go to this to the other job, because if I went to BBC at the state I was in, there was a high probability that I would have just left like 6 months into it, because I was not in a state of mind that I wanted to work. I didn't want to be in work. I just wanted to fix, get myself fixed. I knew that if I worked in Deloitte, like, even if I had like dark days, I knew that I had someone else like that I could like kind of confide in and say like, "Hey, this is the shit times I'm going through." Like, even if you might not be going through the same thing, like, at least you can understand. So like, that was like the major reason why I was like, "All right, I'm picking this lower paid job significantly lower paid job than this like really high paid lucrative job with BBC. And like it took like my parents didn't understand that. They didn't understand the idea of just like going for a lower paid job, but like they knew I was doing it for my happiness, so that they kind of just gave me their blessing to do it. And like I wanted to rise up the ranks as quickly as possible so that I was earning as much as I was earning, I was supposed to be earning in BBC in a shorter amount of time. And obviously when I didn't get that promotion, I came in February, so the justification was like, he didn't fulfill the 6 months to make it 3 years, so like we wouldn't promote you. And I was like, all right, that's bullshit, but go on, do it, do what you need to do. So it was when I didn't get that promotion, that's when I started formulating the idea of just like being responsible for my work. And also that was the day that I decided that I needed the kill switch. I needed to make sure that if I was to leave Deloitte, everything that I built for them would go with me, and that kill switch is in place, obviously. So because like for me, that's how I work, man. If you screw me over, like I'm not gonna just be like laying down to take it. I'm gonna work my way into it. And yeah, currently at Deloitte, 1 year in. We'll see how things go this year. But for me, with Deloitte or any company, like I have no ties, especially this company, I have no ties to it. Look, the reason I'm here, I came here from a friend. Like I have no interest in consulting is bullshit. Yeah, and I will eventually leave this place. Just waiting for once Willie is tired of this place, I have no ties to it, and I will leave as well. But that's really the nature of it, man. I'm not here for myself, man. I'm here for like other people. I really don't care about this place at all. Never have, never will. And I remember it was the second day of being at Deloitte, and I was like. Because, like, we had another friend who was applying to Deloitte as well. And immediately I stepped into that place. I was like, you would not like it here. Like, it's a good thing you went for the other one. You would not like it here. You would hate it here. Because, like, if I'm the type of person who doesn't like things. I mean, it takes a lot for me to not like something. And if I don't like it in the second day that I'm in there, no one, like, someone who, like, gets easily annoyed would not like it. And I was like, yeah, no, this is not the work environment that you need to be in. Just go for your, just wait for your Morgan Stanley, just do your CTO life, and then, yeah, that's how it went down. And over the years, you can see, like, my ambition has faltered, definitely has faltered, because, like, I was once a kid that wanted to be successful, but now I am quite complacent, I'm quite okay with being average, being less than average, in fact, being less of what I can be. So is ambition innate? I don't know. Is it that I'm blocking myself from being ambitious because of my situation? Is my situation stopping my ambition? Or is my ambition being stopped because I have no environment to push for ambition? That's interesting. Yeah, so it's about nearly 1:45, so I'll leave that as part one of the ambition story. The next part is probably going to be a shorter one, probably like half an hour, 1 hour. Part two, I'll probably discuss ambition in relationships and ambition, like how relationships can define ambition, and the idea of dating up and dating down, because I think that's a really, really interesting topic to talk about. So yeah, this is going to be part one of this ambition trail, and I hope it was enlightening for you, and I hope you had to look at your own ambition and think about like how you can succeed. And anyway, you know what? See you next time.
keep it classy.